It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This Thursday night at Rodef Shalom in Oakland, it's an evening with Roz Chast, presented by the Family Hospice and Palliative Care Center. Ms. Chast, an award-winning New Yorker cartoonist and author, will present a lighthearted look at her experiences with aging parents, which she chronicles in her illustrated memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?, which deals with aging, dying, and death, particularly as it pertained to her parents. She joins us by phone from Connecticut. Roz Chast, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you. Hi.
Hi. Good to have you. And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. And on Twitter at ESSPGH. If you have a story you'd like to share about your aging parents, how you dealt with the issues that complicates that particular part of life, we'd like to have you call in and share your stories with us at 412-246-2002. Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant is a great title for a book about this topic, Roz, because it's something many of us put off dealing with until the day we have to deal with it. How did this journey with your aging parents that we all will go through or have gone through open your eyes to this issue?
Well, before I had to go through it myself, I suppose I felt that, I didn't really think about it very much. And my ideas about old age were pretty much, you know, informed by books and movies where, first of all, it's usually not mentioned, but if it is, somebody gets very old and then they take it to their bed and then 3 weeks later they're gone. And I just didn't know that the extent to which these last chapters could be drawn out or just how painful they could be for, you know, mostly for the people going through it, you know, themselves, but also for everybody around them.
So it's interesting because I think that picture you just painted is sort of the picture we all have that, this is going to be a natural, you know, it's part of the natural cycle of life and it's going to be very simple and easy and
cycle of life, blah, blah, blah. And you don't usually think about it. And when old age at all is shown, you know, on TV, you think about like Centrum Silver ads, and it's, you know, this is not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about some like 55 or 65 year old with gray hair playing, you know, tennis or squash or something. This is something completely different.
How does the fact that we're all living longer complicate the whole thing?
Well, I think that Western medicine, we've gotten better at extending the lifespan. You know, I think about in my grandparents' time, people might have lived to, you know, 65 or 70 or 75, and they died. And we certainly extended that lifespan, but I'm not sure if the last few years for a lot of people are really good years. And, you know, then you start asking questions like, well, is it only about, like, quantity? I don't know, you know, because I'm not at that point. So I don't know what I would feel like if I were, you know, 95 and lying in a bed and, you know, incontinent and couldn't get out of bed and couldn't really eat and was barely awake and all these people were employed in keeping me alive. Maybe I would feel very different from the way I feel now, but I don't know.
What is it about, I mean, you know, when I look and think about your work, you seem to have a really good grasp on just human nature. And I know that it is, for most of us, you know, very easy to procrastinate, particularly when it comes to dealing with something that isn't pleasant. And yet Americans are so proactive about, you know, planning for retirement and planning for this and that and you know, crossing, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's when it comes to the legality of this thing or that. But it, for whatever reason, it seems to be difficult for us to deal with our own mortality and that of our parents. What insights have you gained into why that is?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of, you know, thoughts about it. I feel like one thing is that our culture does not like to think about people who are not consumers anymore, you know, where they don't go out and shop, and so advertising doesn't really need to address them. And I don't know. It's just like a whole part of life that's not really in our consciousness as a sort of national consciousness, I think. But, you know, maybe that's too, maybe I'm generalizing. I don't know.
Did you have any inkling that you would be writing and illustrating, writing an illustrated book about this?
No, not at all. I've never done anything like this. You know, this is the first long form book I've ever done.
At what point did the idea of a book become a reality or something that you thought could become a reality? And obviously it has because it's a bestseller now.
I'm not really sure. It wasn't, you know, it's certainly not at the beginning of things. You know, I was just pretty wrapped up in dealing with that, with what I had to deal with. But, you know, I think by nature I write stuff down and I make stories out of it. And all the way along I was drawing cartoons about certain things. I mean, a lot of the pages in the book were just things I had done, you know, all the way along, like the conversation I had with my mother about the ancient oven mitt or, you know, the Ouija board incident or, you know, the conversation I had with my mother about the shoes, you know, the sex talk or, you know, there's one in there, I think it's called Rashomon, about riding a bicycle. You know, there were a lot of things that were just things I had written up as part of my regular, you know, cartoon life that, you know, I never thought that they'd be in a book necessarily. I had submitted them to the New Yorker as part of my regular weekly submissions, and, you know, they were rejected for one reason or another. But they wound up in the book.
I want to go back to earlier in your life, how you became a cartoonist and how your parents reacted to the idea that this was something that you were going to make your life's work in those early formative years of your young life.
I think I always knew I was going to do something with art. I can't remember ever thinking that I would ever, you know, do anything aside from art. I loved drawing cartoons. I loved drawing funny pictures. I loved looking at cartoons. I loved Mad Magazine. I loved Charles Adams. I think there was just something, I loved it when something could really make me laugh. I mean, that was just really like the best thing ever. I think my parents were enormously proud. You know, they were New Yorker subscribers. They were educators. My mother was an assistant principal. My father was a teacher. They were, you know, longtime subscribers to the New Yorker, and they were familiar with the cartoons. And I think that it was definitely a different sensibility from their sensibility, which is more like, you know, jokes. They liked to tell, well, my mother liked to tell jokes, you know, guy goes to the doctor, blah, 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 punchline. You know, you know, Sadie and Shirley are walking down Flatbush Avenue and blah, 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 punchline. You know, they liked that kind of, and all
the Henny Youngman,
like that.
The Henny Youngman borscht belt
but,
type thing.
You know, I don't think they always got my sense of humor, but they were very proud.
And
I think they thought I'd be an art teacher. But, you know.
Well, when did you know that I'm good at this and I'm destined for big things?
Destined for big things. I never really thought that I could do anything else, and I still don't. I mean, there are so many things that I'm just sure I would never be able to do. So it kind of it narrowed the field a lot.
Don't you love that process of elimination when you know, I know I'm going to do this because I really don't think that there's anything else.
I can't do anything else. You know, I'm just, I can't, the idea of working in an office and having to deal with other people day in and day out is just, I don't want anybody to boss me around, and I don't want to boss anybody around. I just cannot deal with it. and I'm horrible at math, and, you know, I would not say that, you know, I'm Quasimodo, but, you know, my looks were never going to, you know, sell tickets. And, you know, teaching, just the idea that I was not very fond of school. I couldn't wait to get out of school, in fact. So, you know, athletics, forget it. There were, you know, a lot of things were just kind of crossed off the list. So, you know, it's like, okay, you know, art, all right, that sounds good.
This is all sounding pretty familiar. Roz Chast is our guest. She is a New Yorker cartoonist, award-winning cartoonist, and her best-selling memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It deals with aging, dying, and death, particularly as it pertained to her parents. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have a comment or a question, something about your own life that relates to what we're talking about, we'd love to hear from you. 412-246-2002, the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter, at ESSPGH. Roz, you sketched your mother while she lay dying. Was that something that helped you? Was that a therapeutic thing? How would you describe it?
It was something to do. It's kind of, there's really nothing to do when you're sitting at your parents' bedside and you want to be with them, but they're, you know, in that stage of life where they're not really talking anymore. They're sleeping most of the time. And there was just nothing to do. I mean, I suppose I could have brought knitting, but I wanted to be with her, I think, in a more, in a deeper way. And for me, drawing is part of that.
You remarked that the hospice person who was with your father said that when an aging person is dying, they choose when they actually die. And I've heard of this, but I didn't really think it was possible, but apparently it is?
She said that she had seen it numerous times, and that is what happened with my father. I mean, she said this was, you know, I don't know whether it was more common than not, but that she had seen it enough times that it was not a rarity or, you know, an anomaly, that oftentimes she had seen when the person was dying, if there was a person, you know, their loved one was doing, you know, was with them, you know, for that 24 hours, the minute that person left to go to the bathroom or something, that would be when they would go. And that is what my father did, you know, and I believe it makes sense to me because they were so connected to one another. And my mother was with him the entire time when he was passing. And she left the room ever so briefly. You know, I think at this point his breathing, from what I understand, had, you know, he was definitely leaving. But he didn't leave until she was away from his bedside.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with Roz Chast. Let's go to Lynn in Mount Lebanon. Lynn, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Roz.
Thank you, Paul. Roz, I've read your book, and I found it absolutely fascinating. It was funny. It was sad. It traveled the entire range of emotions that I'm sure one feels at this point in time. I wondered how having experienced this has made you think about how you're planning to talk with your children about what you want at the end of life.
Well, it's hard. I know how I feel about it right now. But the idea, you know, I also know that it's possible that if I got to that point, I'd feel very differently. I mean, right now, I feel like the idea of lying in bed for a year, you know, drinking and sure, and having somebody change my diaper, you know, several times a day, and I'm barely there, it just seems like a complete nightmare. And it's not something I would want at all. I think my kids are aware of that.
So,
but, you know, it's hard to know what you're going to feel like when you're there, I think.
Lynn, thank you for that phone call. And I guess, Roz, I would follow up by asking, are there things that you feel pretty certain you can tell your children about what you want or how you want things handled? Or is it, as you've said a number of times, I don't know if I'm going to know till I'm there. So
one thing I think about a lot, and again, I don't know how I would feel about it then, is, and I think that this has been sort of under the radar, but people are starting to talk about it, is a little bit, is, and it's somehow, I think, connected to the, the idea of legalizing marijuana was sort of impossible to even think about until recently. And I think about the use of certain drugs at the end of life that might make the experience just either less bad, not just less bad, but maybe positive, maybe more interesting. And not just, you know, stuff that at this point, you know, just terrible drugs that don't really do anything, you know, that just sort of prolong the process. But, you know, I have a page in the book where I think I'm more serious than I feel almost comfortable admitting about, you know, opium or psychedelics or...
you mentioned heroin, I think.
And now I'm not talking about, like, sending your kid out to, you know, buy it from some shady friend or something. But maybe if the medical, you know, community was a little less afraid of that, and if the person was having a very bad time, other drugs could be administered to kind of, you know, bring them back to whatever. But to just use that time, use whatever you're going through at that time of life, and maybe something that could not just knock you out and make you be, you know, unconscious, but could actually open your mind a little bit more to what's going on, you know, to the death of the physical body, you know.
We're talking with Roz.
But I don't think that...
I'm sorry, go ahead. I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that we don't even really have a vocabulary to talk about in this country. I think we're very, very, you know, materialistic. And even religion is materialistic. We, you know, we talk about heaven and hell, and, you know, it's almost, you know, like, can we move beyond these things? And I don't know. We don't really talk that much about what we really think about that, you know, because it's so speculative. And but then I think when you get to the end of your life, it becomes more real.
We're talking with
the death of the body. I'm talking about.
Sure. We're talking with Roz Chass. She's a New Yorker cartoonist, and her best-selling memoir is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It deals with aging, dying, and death, and we will continue our conversation, and you're welcome to join it at 412-246-2002. We need to break. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast, whose best-selling memoir is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? She will be presenting at Rodef Shalom in Oakland on Thursday night. It's an evening with Roz Chast, presented by the Family Hospice and Palliative Care Center. And again, Ms. Chast's book focuses on aging, dying, and death, particularly as it pertained to her parents. And Roz, one of the things that you say that you had a chance to do was to be closer to each of your parents as they were dying. How did that happen?
Well, I'm an only child, and there wasn't really anyone else to do it. my parents were, by the time they came up to live near me in an assisted living place, they were both 94. They had been living in their apartment in Brooklyn, where I grew up, for almost 50 years. And but the 10 years before that, I had started going out and visiting them, and you know, with some regularity, and just sort of checking up on them and making sure they were okay, and bringing out groceries when they stopped, you know, really doing much shopping. And yeah, so I was there. There wasn't really anyone else to do it.
But you had a chance. It sounds like you had a chance to, in spending time with them, to perhaps get to know them in a deeper way than before?
Yes and no. I mean, it's complicated because they really were very much who they always were. If anything, they were even more so. And I was the same person I was before. And they were very, very close to each other, and I don't think that I was that close to them as a unit. I was very fond of my dad, and I did love my mother, but we were not close. We were not that close. And, you know, that didn't really change very much. You know, I did the best I could, I think, I hope. But, you know, there are certain things that just don't really change that much. I mean, I wish I could give this more of a sort of TV movie sort of spin, but, you know. And then in the last month, we all grew together as a family, and we cried and laughed, and we realized how much we loved each other. And, you know, and it wasn't like that, you know.
But we would definitely want to steer clear of the TV movie ending, for sure. Let's go to Kurt on the South Side. He has a question. Kurt, you're on with Roz Chast. Welcome.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I was wondering if you think psychedelics could be used to help people with their transition at the end of life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm interested in that, very much so.
Yeah, I'm familiar
It would have to be the right circumstances. You know, as I said, I'm not, you know, interested in sending out one of my kids to, you know, buy something off the street that knows what the hell it is. But I hope so, and I think it's possible.
Do you think that there should be more research done in that area?
Yes,
like possibly
definitely.
Legalization of, you know, medical uses for certain psychedelics?
Yes, definitely, definitely. And I wish that there were. I wish that there was more research into that. I think, you know, I think Michael Pollan, I'm not sure, may have had an article about the use of psilocybin in terminal cases, you know, illness or aging, and, you know, people who are extremely old. And, you know, yeah, definitely.
Roz, what do you want most for people to take from this book?
Yikes. Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. I feel like my parents were very interesting people, and I did love them, and I think they did love me. And, you know, I guess I hope that from reading the book, they get to know them a little bit, and, you know, can get a sense of who they were, what they sounded like, you know, that they were here, that they existed. And you know, some things were kind of funny. Some things were really sad. I guess that's it.
And you say we don't do well as a society, not only acknowledging that people get old, but that they need a lot of help. What practical advice?
Yeah.
What practical advice would you offer to people based on what you have experienced?
Well, there's two pieces of advice. One is, if you are the person, the main caretaker, or the only caretaker for your parents, get a little notebook, because I'm really bad with, maybe people would know this, like, right off the bat. I mean, I didn't, because I'm really bad with, I think, I would call it logistics, you know, when there's a lot of sort of grown-up sort of information that you need to know about things, like forms and, you know, calling some Department of Social Services and who you talk to and, you know, what you talked about and the date you talked to them and what they said. Have a notebook where you put down all this information, where you list your parents' Social Security numbers, because I didn't know them, but it turned out that I needed to know them for a lot of things, a lot of these kinds of forms. So write that down. Write down conversations you have with people at various, places, you know, social services, or some, maybe there's a place where you hired somebody to come in and take care of your, you know, mother for a few hours a week. You know, how much does it cost? So you have an information where you have a notebook where you have all this practical information. What medications are your parents on? What's the dosage? Who's the doctor? Who are all their doctors? What are their telephone numbers? You know, their neighbor. What are their neighbor's telephone numbers in case you have to reach them? All this information should be in one place where you can access it. And the other thing is, if you don't know anything, as I did not know, about, like, your parents' finances or, you know, how to set up a will or what a health care proxy is, which are something I just had never even heard this term. You know, I knew what health care was, and I knew sort of what a proxy was, but I had no idea what a health care proxy was. Get an elder lawyer, you know, and maybe you have a friend. I was lucky I had a friend who had used an elder lawyer who was happened to be in Brooklyn, and he was so helpful. You know, just knowing what questions to ask my parents about, you know, who did not want to talk about death and they didn't want to talk about money. And, you know, he was able to, you know, get their trust so that, you know, we could figure out some of these things. It would have been, without his help, it would have been immeasurably more difficult to sort of figure out how to do a lot of the stuff that I was doing. So, you know, those two things. Get a notebook where you write down a lot of stuff, you know, this practical stuff, and get an elder lawyer.
And Christine sent an email saying that the process seems to be so overwhelming, and she was wondering how you began to navigate hospice care and preparing for their end of life with health care, Medicare, financial matters. But it sounds like you just really answered that question. It's just to be proactive about it and not procrastinate.
Well, I mean, I don't think I was necessarily proactive. I dealt with things as they came along. I think that if you're the only person, there's a lot of stuff you're going to have to do, you know. And it's kind of like if you have a baby, you may not know how to take care of that baby, but you're going to have to figure it out. And I always feel like I'm so bad at this stuff that if I can figure it out, anybody can figure it out, you know.
Our guest has been award-winning New Yorker cartoonist and author Roz Chast. Her best-selling illustrated book is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And on Thursday, it will be a conversation with an evening, I should say, with Roz Chast, presented by the Family Hospice and Palliative Care Center at Road F. Shalom in Oakland. Again, that's Thursday night. Roz Chast, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up, an interview with film producer Nancy Spielberg about her documentary Above and Beyond, about a group of Jewish American pilots who risked everything to fly for Israel in its war of independence. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 1948, with the State of Israel in its formative stages, a group of Jewish American pilots answered a call for help. In secret and at great personal risk, they smuggled planes out of the United States, trained behind the Iron Curtain, and flew for Israel in its War of Independence. My guest, Nancy Spielberg, has produced the first major feature-length documentary about the foreign airmen in the 48 War. It's called Above and Beyond. It brings together new interviews as well as stunning aerial footage. And it had its Pittsburgh premiere last night, and it will be released on video on demand later this month. And by the time this interview is done, I'm sure you're going to want to see it. I'm joined now in studio by Nancy Spielberg. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is not a chapter that was really taught in our history books. How did you become aware of this incredible story, and what led you to decide that you wanted to tell it on film?
You know, I actually thought I was pretty well-versed in history and mostly some of Israel's history, but somebody sent me an email with an obituary, and the obituary was titled, Father of the Israeli Air Force Dies at 94. And, you know, I don't make it a habit of reading obituaries, but in this case, as I read, I expected it to talk about Yossi so-and-so or some Israeli. And instead, it mentioned a man named Al Schwimmer. And he was a TWA flight engineer. And it talked about how he masterminded smuggling airplanes out of the U.S. against a State Department, a U.S. embargo against sending anything to the combatant parties in the Middle East as the British were pulling out of Palestine in 48 and Israel was voted into statehood. And everybody knew there was going to be a war. And Al Schwimmer decided that Israel needed an air force. They had no air force. And he smuggled planes and recruited his buddies with the FBI chasing him. It was like, you know, a huge story. And it was an incredible story. So it just hooked me. It hooked me because I actually thought it should be a feature film.
And you had to tell a great deal of backstory, you know, explaining how Israel evolved out of the Holocaust and World War II. It's something everyone ought to know, but apparently a lot of folks do not.
I think people do not, and part of that could be because what people think they know of Israel is what they see on the current news. And really, there's so much more. This is an ancient homeland. It's an ancient country. And really what happened under British rule and what led leading up to the – there was a partition plan. 1947, there was a partition plan dividing the country between an Arab state, you know, for the Arabs and for the Jews. And the Jews had accepted that two-state solution in 47, but the Arabs at that time rejected it and vowed to fight. So there's a lot of backstory. We actually had to sort of cut it down because there's only so much you can fit into a film, but it was necessary to lay some of the details. The British were in. They couldn't stay there any longer. They were pulling back from a lot of different occupied areas in Africa. You know, the British Empire was huge and had to pull back. This was one of the places they were leaving.
Yeah, the British seemed to have kind of slinked out because they didn't want to deal with it.
They didn't want to deal with it, and they also wanted to keep a good footing, a good relationships within the oil world.
They didn't want to upset the Arabs.
Well,
and it was about oil. So
it's always about oil.
That kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yep, it sounds like today.
So how did these Jewish American pilots get involved in the war effort?
After they had served in World War II, and this film is about a small group of American pilots, and there were volunteers beyond the pilots, but when they came back from serving in World War II, they weren't getting their lives on track for different reasons. They were not being hired by commercial airlines. Commercial airlines at that time would not hire Jewish pilots. Maybe that pilot mentality of action and daredevil was, you know, it was just hard to go sell shoes or insurance. You know, it was hard to be the ordinary Joe when you've come back as a celebrated hero. You know, you've got your leather jacket on and the women are swooning and suddenly, you know, you're really wearing a suit and going door to door selling something.
Yeah, one of the pilots who had, I think he had achieved the highest decoration that you could in the Navy as a Navy pilot in World War II, Leon Frankel.
Right.
He's talking about how I think he was selling cars in North Dakota or something.
Right. And he was doing very well because he talked about having money, girlfriends, cars, the whole enchilada, as he says.
But something was missing.
For him, yes. And part of his – everybody had a different reason, but some of their motivation was actually anti-Semitism that they themselves faced in this country growing up in, you know, in the 20s and 30s where he would get beat up coming home from school every day. So that sort of hung out there. And then what they experienced in World War II, liberating the camps, watching what had happened, seeing these Jewish refugees coming into Israel, and really walking into another potential genocide, into a country surrounded by five armies that were hell-bent on making sure that it didn't get a chance at its birth, you know, of trying to really end it right there. So I think those were the factors. In some ways, they felt it was part of their good service, of continuation of their World War II service. You know, so that was his motivation probably, because he was successful, but I think he had just had enough.
And what is particularly interesting and perhaps a little surprising is that a lot of these Jewish American pilots, at least at first, some of them are ambivalent about the whole thing, the cause, about their Jewish heritage and the cause of Israel.
Right, right.
That is interesting because this became sort of how they – this was part of their search for finding themselves.
Right. Without realizing it, they were actually – they evolved. The guys that we interviewed, only one, Gidi Lichtman, who's the guy with a very colorful language, our saltiest character.
Yes.
He's the only one that was brought up with any understanding of Palestine and Zionism and that love. The other ones were very ambivalent about their Jewishness. It did nothing but get in their way. They got beat up from school and then they couldn't get jobs. Why would they embrace that? You know, they were pushing it away. They didn't go because they felt compelled as Jews to go. They went because they felt it was the right thing to do. And some of them just missed the action. They missed their band of brothers. So, you know, it was very interesting. In fact, that's what I actually loved about these guys, is that they found themselves in a situation where they, you know, would say, we're here to help you people in Israel. We're here to help you. And then they didn't realize that they were part of them. They weren't separate from them. So that Jewish pride came out. And it's a personal journey for them.
And eventually this becomes the cause of their lives and perhaps even more meaningful, certainly to some of these pilots, than their World War II service was, because of it becomes apparent, if for no other reason than the fact that they're risking everything to do this.
They're risking everything, and there were so few of them that they played a much larger, more important role than being part of the big machine in World War II. You know, because here they could – each one could make a difference, and they made a difference, each one. Although when they came back, they weren't talking about it because the FBI still had files on them. They were looking for them. So they kept it quiet. They – you know, some of the guys never spoke about it. Their kids knew something, but they thought one day FBI is going to knock on their door with this, you broke the law back in 48 and we're here to, you know, handcuff you. So they kept it quiet.
We're talking about the film that debuted in Pittsburgh last night, Above and Beyond, about Jewish American pilots fighting for Israel in the war of 1948 as Israel fights for its existence. The producer of the film, Nancy Spielberg, is here. And yes, she is the sister of Steven Spielberg. So I figured at some point we'll get to that.
You can't escape it. It's the elephant in this little room.
Yes.
It's a nice elephant. It's okay.
Absolutely. And I'm sure he's proud of what you've done here.
I'm so proud, yeah.
So you were saying that this would make a good feature film. Do you see that happening perhaps down the road?
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually, I'm working on that now.
Okay.
So that's all I can say. Yeah. That sounded so secret and clandestine. I've been hanging around with these guys too long.
we have a clip from the film about and you know, one of the things we learn in this film is that the veterans could buy planes, which became a key part of how they procure the planes and the equipment. And we have a clip from the film that explains how they go about this illegal endeavor. And we're going to hear Jewish American pilots Harold Livingston and then Leon Frankel. Let's listen.
The important point at this time was to recruit crews. We had these airplanes, but no one to fly them. My first job was not flying. It was scouring the stolen records of New York Air National Guard rosters, looking for Jewish-sounding names with pilot status.
I got this phone call from New York apprising me that Israel was going to declare itself a state, that they had purchased some airplanes, but they had no one to fly them.
And one of the things, and again, that was we just heard from two American pilots who flew for Israel, Harold Livingston and then Leon Frankel. And one of the things that you do a great job of getting across is just how brave these men were, because these planes, literally, as we find out, are put together with dunk.
Yeah, they're like Band-Aids. I mean, first of all, they were buying World War II surplus planes as is. And we had graveyards. I mean, this is a wealthy country. The desert was literally filled with row upon row of these planes. And you bought them as is, which meant that instead of plexiglass, there's, you know, plywood, which you can fall out of, you know. and sometimes they were missing part of a propeller. So they would try to outfit them the best they could. But then when they actually – these pilots made it over slowly to Italy, where they gathered together. It was like the headquarters to gather the pilots, and from there to Czechoslovakia. And the Czechs were the only ones that agreed to sell Israel planes. And Israel's first fighter planes were Czechoslovakian-made Messerschmitts. So here are the planes.
And these were planes that they made for the Germans.
They made for the Germans, but they were now using the wrong engine because the engine factory burnt down. So they put a heavier engine from a bomber into a little plane, which threw the whole thing off. So the synchronized machine guns weren't synchronized. They were shooting off their own propellers in the air. So, you know, and they literally, like Tinker Toys, pieced them together. And Americans had to learn how to fly the planes that were shooting down in World War II. And the planes would flip over on takeoff, on landing. I think more people got hurt or killed just because the planes were crappy, not because they were in dogfights. You know?
Right.
So they had everything working against them, that was for sure.
And not all of the pilots were Jewish or American.
Correct, correct. In fact, 20% of the Air Force were not Jewish. At Canada's top ace pilot, Buzz Buehrling, he had more kills in World War II. They called him the Falcon of Malta. He decided, he was a devout Protestant, he decided he wanted to go and fight for Israel. And on the way over, his plane blew up. He was testing a plane in Italy where they were gathering these pilots. Some people thought it was sabotage, but he and his co-pilot were killed instantly. So there were several that went because they thought it was the right thing to do.
And as we will learn, I don't think it's giving away too much of the story, some of these men made the ultimate sacrifice. They lost their lives.
Correct, correct. Right, and that's, you know, very tragic when you see they were 26 years old, 27 years old. You know, they thought they were doing the right thing. And, you know, I don't think that pilots, I think they're sort of a crazy crowd. You know, I don't think they think about dying. I mean, you get into a crappy plane and you fly in a war with people shooting at you and you're not afraid. You know, they're made, they have moxie. There's something about them that they are daredevils.
412-246-2002 if you want to join our conversation with Nancy Spielberg about the film Above and Beyond, which is an amazing documentary. We would have time to take a question or two, and of course I have plenty more for you. Why Czechoslovakia? Why was Czechoslovakia the only country that would help?
That's really a good question. People are often very surprised. Why Czechoslovakia? Czechoslovakia had just come out from under German rule and was under Russian, like the Russians were coming in. The Czechs, I think they connected with Israel's struggle for independence because they themselves were having that struggle. But they also needed the money. And there were Americans that had gathered millions of dollars to buy those planes in Czechoslovakia. So they got American dollars. And they also, I think the Russians let it happen. They were hoping that Israel was going to be set up as a socialist government. So they sort of turned their eye away and let the Czechs conduct this business. So it really – and Czechoslovakia has always been there for Israel in many ways.
And, you know, when we think of Israel today and you know, the Israeli military, the Israeli Air Force, I mean, is it fair to say it's one of the best in the world?
They say it's one in the top five.
So it's hard to imagine how – literally, they're starting from scratch in 1948.
Right.
And one of the most striking parts of the film is that at first, four people and four junk airplanes are what make up the Israeli Air Force. This is how this great Air Force began.
Began in the very first aerial mission on May 29th. They went out. The Egyptians were almost in Tel Aviv. They had a column. They were moving into Tel Aviv. They would have been in the next morning, and that would have been the end. And these four little planes went out and attacked. And their bombs didn't really do damage, except psychologically, the Egyptians realized, they thought this was just the beginning of more planes to come. They stopped. They'd never advanced after that. But in that very first mission, Eddie Cohen, a South African, was killed. So they lost 25% of their air force in the very first mission. They went back with only three planes and three pilots.
Incredible. And it's striking how little training they had.
Very little training. But, you know, they Israelis today, actually, it's funny because our pilots trained the Israelis, the very first school of Israeli pilots, including Danny Shapiro, which was Israel's top test pilot. So in some ways, the Americans came in with little training, but a lot of, you know, flying by the seat of their pants, I guess, you know.
Let's go to Greg quickly in Mount Lebanon, who has a question. Hi, Greg. You're on with Nancy Spielberg.
Hi, good afternoon.
Yes.
Hey, I have a 12-year-old good Catholic boy son who loves history and hates oppression. Is this movie going to be appropriate for him? Because it sounds like something he would absolutely love, the people winning against oppression.
You know, I have to say that this is an uplifting film. And outside of the fact, don't get mad at me, there's a few colorful words, and I'm sure your 12-year-old has heard them before, because one of the pilots should not be censored. It's really, kids are actually loving the film. That, like I said, a little colorful language, but there's a lot of uplifting. There could be a couple of graphic pictures, but considering what children see on the big screen and television, this ain't nothing.
And the swearing by the one pilot, I'm trying to remember his name.
Giddy Lichtman.
Giddy Lichtman. He he swears in a historical context because he's referring to the Messerschmitt.
Right.
But he's not saying Messerschmitt because he's talking about the conditions of the plane at the time they acquired him. And
right.
You can use your imagination to see what he did with that. The aerial footage is striking. By the way, Greg, thank you for that phone call. The aerial footage is striking. How did you put it together?
The aerial footage is a combination of archival footage that we actually found, but there wasn't a lot. We shot recreations. We hired two planes, a Spitfire and a Messerschmitt. And then, and this is where the Spielberg part pays off a little, I called somebody at Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's company, and I said, I want you guys to do the CGI work, the computer-generated imaging, because I needed flying sequences. I couldn't find 12 Spitfires, nor could I afford them because this was all done with funds raised not for profit. And the head of ILM, Kathy Kennedy, is the head of Lucasfilms. I know her. She worked with my brother for years. And they said, it happens to be our quiet season and we can do some of this pro bono. So that was huge. So it was a combination of archival footage, recreations, and computer-generated imaging. And then what we did is we made it all feel that it was – we sort of dirtied up the footage, so it feels like
okay.
It's archival footage.
I was wondering about that because I'm saying I can't tell if this is real archival footage or if this is a recreation. I can't tell the difference.
Then we did a good job.
Yes, you did.
Well, not me personally, but listen, I know how to hang with the best. What can I say?
And we've got about 30 seconds left, but at the end of the day, these pilots, you mentioned how this changed their experience, that their feelings about being Jewish, the Jewish experience for them, and they feel at the end of the day as though they're trying to prevent another Holocaust.
They feel that they were trying to prevent another Holocaust. They helped these survivors that had never been, you know, this was their chance for some sense of happiness and being in their homeland. And I just think they felt that this validated their existence. You know, these pilots felt it was the most important thing they did in their lives.
It is an important film, to be sure. Above and Beyond, a documentary produced by our guest, Nancy Spielberg.
iTunes, April 28th. That's when you can see it. Video on demand and on demand at Amazon and other places also.
That sounds great. We'll look forward to it. And congratulations on the
film.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, Nancy Spielberg in town for the J-Fest, which continues tonight. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We'll continue with our show tomorrow. Until then, so long for now.